This week we are continuing in our sermon series on half-truths, things that Christians say all the time, things that might be found in the Bible, words that we try to say to comfort and encourage one another in times of need, and sometimes words that we have to be careful with because while there is an element of truth to them, they might be harmful. In the last couple of weeks, we've talked about how God won't give me more than I can handle, or everything happens for a reason. And this week, we're talking about God helps those who help themselves. And so I want to bring up a Bible passage for you this morning and talk about where we get this idea. It comes from the book of James, which is one of the shortest books in the whole Bible, but it's packing a punch. It says this. What good is it, dear brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith, but don't show it by your actions? What kind of faith can save anyone? Suppose you see a brother or a sister who has no food or clothing, and you say, goodbye, have a good day, stay warm and eat well. But then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? I think this passage for me illustrates the ways in which some of the things we say as Christians can have an undertone of judgment. And for me, this third cliche, that God helps those who help themselves, is probably one of the most judgmental that we've encountered thus far in the sermon series as we've been talking and unpacking these half-truths together. I've heard other cliches like this that are a little bit more secular, perhaps. Like, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You made your bed, now sleep in it. Right. These are all things we say when we encounter a challenge or a difficulty or someone in some place who has a need that surpasses our understanding or our motivation to help them resolve that need. And so we go to this cliche like, God helps those who help themselves. And we go there perhaps from a place of privilege. I know that I do that as a white woman who is well educated and works full time and lives in a very nice house. I go to that cliche from a place of privilege because I know that I experience God as a God who is present with me, who walks with me, who helps me in my times of need, and I expect that to be true for others. We trust God to be our helper, don't we? We pray to God and we expect that God will hear our prayers, will intervene on our behalf, will answer our prayers, and yes, will even perform miracles. God helps those who help themselves is indeed true because we cling to these tenets of our faith. We cling to this characteristic of God as our helper. There's passages all over the Old Testament and the New Testament that talk about God as a helper, God who heals the blind, who heals the sick, who performs miracles by feeding many people with very little, who works in people's lives to bring about good news, to bring about new life, and experiences that are transformative in body and mind and spirit. And so we look to God as our helper. We understand that promise to be true in our lives. But when we start promising it to others, it gets a little complicated. It gets complicated when we expect God to give us good health, but we don't take care of ourselves as whole people. We don't care for ourselves emotionally or physically or psychologically. It gets complicated when we expect God to give us gainful and meaningful employment without pursuing education or training, without a dutiful job search or preparing for job interviews and having a consistent work ethic. It gets complicated when we expect God to help us pass the test when we haven't even cracked a book or started reviewing our notes to study for the test. God helps those who help themselves is a half-truth. We need God. We depend on God to help us, but we also need to help ourselves. When a problem arises in our own lives, God calls upon us and expects us to be proactive, to use our human agency, our independent decision-making power, to work hard for the things we want. That in and of itself is easy to say as a person of privilege, isn't it? We can be proactive. We can try harder. We can do the things that are beyond us. But what do we do and where do we turn when we need help? More than that, where do other people who are more destitute, who are more desperate, who are downtrodden, who are beat up and burnt out, where do they go when they need help? And how do we accept the help that comes to us? I want to tell you a story. It's a story that surfaces anytime there is a natural disaster or a flood or a hurricane or something like that. It's a story about a man who lived in a valley. And when the rains came, there was an evacuation notice served. Everyone in that valley was to evacuate their homes, to pack up what they needed and leave and go to higher ground to be where they could be safe. This man was proud of who he was, proud of his home, and didn't want to leave. And so he stayed in his home. About a half a day into the torrential rains, the volunteer fire crew came through the valley and went door to door on his street and knocked on the door and said, "Hey guy, it's raining. You've got to get out of here. Do you need help? Do you have transportation? Do you have some place to go? Here are the resources if you don't." They offered him a ride on their fire truck, but he refused it and said, "I'm good. My God will save me." 8 to 10 hours later, the rains were still coming down and the water was starting to collect in the valley. The streets were experiencing flash flooding and some basements were even being inundated with water. The man went downstairs to check on his basement and things were damp, but they weren't dire yet. And so he just stayed on the first floor of his house. A knock came at the door and the sheriff was there wading through the water in a set of those wader trousers. And he had a motorized raft waiting nearby. He said, "Come on, now is the time. We've got to get you out of here. We've got to get you to higher ground so that you'll be safe." And once again, the man refused his kind offer and he said, "No, I'm good. My God will save me." The story continues on and the rains keep coming and the last part of the story is the man is found on the rooftop of his home because the waters have escalated just that far and this is the highest point that he can get to be dry and to be safe. And the Coast Guard helicopter comes by loud overhead and they drop him a ladder. And they say, "Come on, man, come on, get out of here. We've got to go. This is your chance. This is your last chance." And he says, "No, I'm good. My God will save me." And the Coast Guard operator yells down to him, "That's what the ladder's for." Latch on. This story is a little dramatic, perhaps. There's a little bit of hyperbole within it. But it's a story about human agency. It's a story about all the ways in which God's people are given opportunities to intervene, to show random acts of kindness, to demonstrate God's grace, to serve others. It's a story about how God helps those who help themselves by getting other people, everyday people just like you and me, involved during times of trouble. It's also a story about responsible grace. United Methodists talk about responsible grace as one of the tenets of our faith. Responsible grace is this idea that God's grace exists for us each and every day. God's grace pursues us, it surrounds us, it upholds us, it hems us in on every side. But we, as human agents, we have the responsibility to take it, to take heart and to take hold of that good news, of that message, and of the opportunity that it gives us to accept forgiveness, to accept new life, to accept second chances, and grow and use that grace to be proactive, to work hard, to try new things, to succeed each in our own way. Responsible grace is the idea that God's grace is always present and working in our lives, and that we each and every day have the choice. We are able to respond to it. Responsible, response able. It's a little play on words. Does that make sense? But here's the hard part about responsible grace for me as someone who's grown up in the United Methodist Church. This is a part of our beliefs that requires us to hold into tension two things. The first part is the human agency part. We believe that as humans, God has given us free will. We have the choice to participate in a relationship with God. We have a choice to accept the grace that God gives us and to live our faith each and every day. We have been given the ability to make decisions for ourselves. And just like the cliche goes, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. We can see how true that is in our world. We decide as people where we're going to spend our time, how we're going to spend our money, who we're going to be in relationship with, and even the little things about what we're going to eat and what we're going to drink and what we're going to wear. We make choices each and every day about how we can seek out our own best interest and the interests of others. We make choices each and every day about how we'll secure a positive future for ourselves and for our children. How we can help ourselves and help others that God has put into our proximity. Some of you know that I have a 3-year-old, and agency and free will is something that we're experimenting with in our household right now. It's really fun, super fun. And one of the things that we're trying to teach Michael is that he does have choices. He can choose how he behaves to some degree at age 3. And so we try not to tell him what he needs to do, but to offer him a choice so that he can participate in that and learn something as he grows. So for an example, we want him to eat fruit and vegetables every day. Right? That's a good choice to make. But we don't wag our finger in his face and say that he has to sit at the dining room table until he clears his plate. That's what happened to me growing up. It didn't work. We offer him choices. We say, Michael, would you like an apple or a banana? Because you're going to eat the fruit, you stinking kid. Do you want to climb into bed or would you like me to carry you into bed? Choices at bedtime are sometimes limited. Do you want to take a bath or a shower? I'm not going to tell him that he stinks and that he has to get in the bathtub and get clean. I'm going to give him a choice about a bath or a shower because he is a person who has agency. And even at age 3, I want him to begin to understand that so that for the rest of his life, he knows that he has choices to make. That there are positive choices and negative choices, that there are positive outcomes, and that there are negative consequences. I want him to know that as a person, but also as a person of faith. so that one day when he is faced with a choice or a consequence, when he is faced with an opportunity to help or to serve, that he'll be able to make an informed choice. Now, the part that's equally true about three-year-olds is that sometimes, no matter how much agency or how many choices you give them, they're still going to want to try to do it all by themselves. Or at least Michael is. He wants to be very independent. He wants to do it all by himself. And sometimes putting on his own shoes in the morning can take 30 minutes because he's going to do it all by himself. Perhaps some of you parents have been there with me. I think this is true for us as adults. It's true for us as people of faith. We want to do it all on our own. We want to be agents who are independent and autonomous, who are free to make our choices and to deal with the consequences ourselves or to reap the benefits and enjoy the success. But as people of faith, we know that we can't do it all on our own. We need God and we need each other in this community. We have agency, but that agency only comes from God's grace that is bestowed to us each and every day. So even before we have the ability to think for ourselves, God is already at work in our lives, building relationships with us, building bridges, and seeking out our own best interest, our own health and welfare. At the end of the day, we can't work our way to God, but we can participate in what God is doing in our life. There's nothing that we can say or do that's going to earn us our salvation, that's going to put us in a better relationship with God, that's going to get us brownie points or Jesus points or any other kind of points. Our relationship with God depends on God's gracious reception of us. Our relationship with God depends on God's gracious reception of us and our gracious reception of God. Our willingness to say, yes, God, I need you in my life. I want your grace to pour over me. I want you to work within me, within my relationships, within the things I do and the things I say each and every day of my life. Unfortunately, sometimes in our life, as hard as we try, as much as we do, things aren't going to go exactly the way we want. We're not going to get every day right. We're not going to answer every question or resolve every problem or solve every dilemma. And these are the moments that we cling to God the most. These are the moments when we go to God in a time of prayer and we say, God, I need your help. I need you in this moment. I need you in this relationship. I need you in this situation. I need you to help me because I'm not sure how to help myself in this moment. Just last night, I was sitting at the dinner table with my son Michael, and the dog was running underneath our dining room table, sniffing for goodies, things that might have been dropped. And my son Michael was perturbed by this. He didn't like that the dog was sniffing at his feet and licking at his toes and doing all of these things. And so he made some quick movements, and he got a little bit off balance, and he fell off of his chair onto the dining room floor. More than that, somehow the dog used her nose to knock his plate onto the ground, and the plate broke, and all the food fell on the floor, and the dog gobbled it up quicker than we could even think to move to resolve the problem. Michael was crying. He was a big hot mess, but he was fine physically. He was more mad than anything that the dog ate his food and that the dog broke the plate, and it was just a wretched, miserable existence for about 3 minutes in the life of Michael Fitzgerald. And we had to do some teaching in that moment thereafter to to say, oh, Michael, Bubba, I'm so sorry that that happened. Sometimes accidents happen and there's nothing you can do to prevent it or to fix it. The plate is broken and now we have to put it in the trash and sweep up the mess. And we'll start again. We'll get you another plate out of the cupboard and we'll serve you another portion of food and we will make it all right again. For me, this teaching moment wasn't just about what happens when your dumb dog jumps all over the place and makes a mess, or what happens when your plate falls down and you have to serve yourself again. It was a lesson about grace. That even amongst the messes we make in our own lives, grace is what we cling to when we have to clean it all up, when we have to stand up and say that we're willing to try again. Grace is the thing that makes it possible for us to gather back around the table with our family, to acknowledge what happened, to say, I'm sorry, and to try again. I think we're always living in the midst of this tension. We're always living in the midst of the tension that bad things happen and that God is our helper, that we are human agents, but we don't always make the best choices. That success is a reality for us in our positions of privilege, and also failure is a reality too. So we as people of faith, I believe, are called to live in that tension. We're called to walk the line. Sometimes we might try to alleviate the tension by going one way or the other, by going all in and saying that we are totally in control of our life and everything that happens to us, because we're awesome, because we're good at life, because we're good at our job, because we're good parents, because we want to make it all work, and we're going to find a way to make it all work. Or we can go the other way and say that there's whims, there's forces at work in our lives that are bigger than ourselves, our jobs, our relationships, the economy. It's not our responsibility. Someone else, far smarter, far bigger than us, more important, is in control. Whether you know that person or not, whether you have a relationship with that person or not, sometimes you give up the ownership. You give up your own agency. You give up your own responsibility. I think for us, the more faithful option, the option that I choose, is to live into the tension, to hold on to the balance between those two things. That on the one hand, we have human agency, and on the other hand, we are dependent and reliant upon something that is bigger than ourselves. I want to tell you one more story, and that's a story that happened to me about 4 years ago. I was a younger pastor, much more spunky and naive than I am now, perhaps. And I was taking a group of middle school and high school students to Atlanta, Georgia, on a mission trip. We made it there, by the grace of God, in one 15-passenger van. That was a really long drive. And we unloaded, and we got to our work site and set up for work on the first day. And we were to be doing some painting inside, and the older kids were up on the roof of the house repairing some shingles that had fallen off in a recent storm. And on the first day, we gathered for lunch out on the patio of a house in the shade of a tree. And my job as one of the leaders was to go to the 15-passenger van that was parked in the driveway and unload the cooler that had the water bottles and the Gatorade and the sack lunches inside of it. It was one of those coolers that had a cup holder in the top of it, you know, like for tailgating and things. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, so in the cover there was a cup holder, and I put my keys in there after I picked up the heavy cooler and started hauling it back to the house to get it where the kids could access it. And then my keys stayed there for as long as we had lunch. And then before I knew it, two of the youth volunteered to take the cooler back to the truck and back to the van and shut the doors all up. And then we went back to work. No big deal. Well, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon came. We were packing up the work site, ready to go back to our overnight accommodations at a local church. And I went to my backpack where I had kept all of their forms and things. And I realized, my keys aren't in my backpack anymore. Where'd the keys go? Oh my gosh, I left the keys in the cup holder of that cooler. And so I thought, no problem, I'll just go to the van and open it up and they'll be right there in the rear of the van. Well, the van was locked. So here I am in inner city Atlanta with 15 youth. And I don't have keys to the van. I don't have a way to transport them back to the church. And more than that, my cell phone is in the glove compartment of the vehicle. So we were stranded. We were stranded. Watching this scene unfold nearby was a man who had set up shop in a tent. He was a homeless person, and he lived in inner city Atlanta, not far from where we were working, but he had acknowledged our whereabouts and was aware that we were working on this house and helping one of the neighbors. We had acknowledged his whereabouts, too. We had taken him a sack lunch earlier in the day and offered him a cold bottle of water as a token, as something that felt like the right thing to do as Christians on the scene. And he said, "Seems like you've got a little issue here with the van." And I said, "Yeah, we've got a little issue." And he says, "Give me half an hour. I'll be right back." And I thought, what are we going to do for half an hour? And he's going to be right back? We don't know this guy. What kind of solution is he going to have for us? Well, sure enough, after about 25 minutes, two men started walking down the street. He was feeling pretty proud of himself, and the other guy had a small bag of tools with him. Turns out he knew a guy. This guy was pretty handy. So handy, in fact, that he used to jack cars for a living and make a lot of money. Landed himself in jail, but he had been recently released, and now he was working for a tow truck company. But he was off of work that day, so he came to our aid. I'm laughing about it now because it's just uncanny. It's amazing what happens when you know a guy and when you pray a prayer like, "God, help me in this moment because I'm not sure what we're going to do. I'm not sure how me and these other 15 kids are going to make it out of this situation. When we don't have the resources we need, we don't know a soul here, and everything that we have to help us is in that van." A few minutes later, we were packed up and ready to rock and roll because he had the right tools to jimmy the lock to get us into the van. We clicked one button. I grabbed my set of keys. I made a quick phone call to say we were still coming to the church, but we were running late, and we were on our way. "God helps those who help themselves" is a half-truth. It's one that I have often said as a person. It's one that I understand can go two ways. As we acknowledge that sometimes in life we are mired in circumstances that are too deep for us to climb out of ourselves. It's one that acknowledges that yes, we are human agents who have the power to make decisions, to seek out our own best interests, to tap into the wisdom that we've learned, but also the wisdom that sometimes situations are bigger than just ourselves. Situations that are bigger than ourselves are situations where we can almost always be assured that God and God's grace is at work in our life. We receive blessings from God even though we don't earn them, we can't buy them, we don't deserve them. Even when we have made a mess of things, God's grace is always available to us. It's the grace that's pursuing us. It's the grace that's surrounding us. It's the grace that's hemming us in. It's part of our faith. It's part of who we are as United Methodists. To be people who accept this grace, but also to be responsible, to be agents, to share it with others. I'm grateful for all the people, for all the ways that this grace has been shared with me, and for all the ways that you all share it with each other. Will you pray with me? God of grace, your presence in our life is palpable today. We know that you are here. We know that you are receiving the gift of worship that we have to offer you. We also know that your grace is at work in our lives. So help us today to open ourselves up to receiving that great gift. And that as we receive it, motivate us to also share it. To participate in the work that you are doing in the world to build up your kingdom here in this place. To serve as a community of faith and work together as brothers and sisters who are united in your love. Amen.